It's early August, and that means a few things in Ohio. Hot, muggy weather, getting ready to head back to class for all the kids, and baseball, the dog days of August. The trade deadline's already passed, so teams are basically set for their playoff runs. The Reds and Indians are both struggling, but not completely out of contention. And not surprisingly, the Yankees and Red Sox are two of the best teams in baseball. Good morning, I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. And this hour, we're talking baseball. More specifically, we're talking about baseball's most mythical pitch, the fastball. From the Cincinnati Reds, Aroldis Chapman throwing what appeared to be the fastest pitch ever recorded earlier this year, to Cleveland Indians great and World War II veteran Bob Feller throwing what might have been the first ever clocked pitch. We're talking fastballs this hour. Why is the pitch so fascinating? Just who is the fastest pitcher ever? We're joined by someone who took it upon himself to find out. Tim Wendell is a decorated author and baseball journalist, and he's the author of the new book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. Tim Wendell, welcome to All Sides.
Yes, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. First of all, is there any credibility to Aroldis Chapman's alleged 106-mile-per-hour reading earlier this year?
Oh, I think there's certainly credibility, but, you know, as I think any baseball fan realizes, radar guns, et cetera, weren't out there even 20-some years ago. So it's very possible that you could say, oh, somebody like a Bob Feller or Nolan Ryan earlier in his career, even back to, say, Walter Johnson or, you know, Sandy Koufax, is certainly in the same league with Chapman. It's funny, I was just up in Cooperstown, and they were kind of anointing Chapman with a new exhibit they have on standards, in a sense, you know, the top, you know, homers, fastest pitch, this type of thing. And we got into a pretty good debate over it. But, you know, I can't disagree, but I don't think everybody quite agrees either.
Why is the fastball so fascinating? Why is it the most fascinating pitch?
Well, Steve, I think it's easily understood. You know, you can take, somebody to a baseball game who may doesn't know a sacrifice bunt from a hit and run, et cetera, but, you know, they see somebody throwing a fastball really fast, and we're talking 100-plus miles an hour, which is pretty much everybody in this conversation, and it gets our attention. I think it just immediately resonates. And I think there's also something about America. We like things fast. We like fast food. We like fast transportation, et cetera. And it's not, say, you know, I don't think it's surprising that, say, Walter Johnson back in his day, back in the 1920s, his nickname was the Big Train, in part because that was the fastest mode of transportation. So I think it's something that's akin to this country, but it's also something that, again, you can take anybody out and, ooh, you know, it's like the roller coaster ride. They immediately see, in a sense, the resonance or the attraction of how fast somebody is throwing.
There's a machismo factor here in play as well, right? Who can stand up and throw the ball the hardest?
Yeah, very much. And I think it's funny, many of the individuals in High Heat, Nolan Ryan, Feller, Koufax, et cetera, they realize, first of all, two things very early on, that they belong to a very select brotherhood, but in many ways they are as curious as we are over who is throwing the fastest or who is arguably the fastest of all time. So whereas they submit themselves to some very bizarre tests well before radar guns, and I'm certainly not the camp that the radar gun is the test of that totally settles everything. But, you know, Feller's throwing against a Harley Davidson motorcycle in a park in Chicago. Nolan Ryan ends up throwing in a very convoluted test with infrared rays and such. Steve Delkowski ends up pitching at Aberdeen Testing Proving Grounds north of Baltimore. So why would they submit to this? I think in some ways they submit to it because they're as curious as the rest of it. The rest of us, how do they stack up against the fastest of all time?
Why is it so difficult to find out who the fastest pitcher of all time is? You talk about the radar gun. I think most people think that's a pretty quantifiable, easy thing to understand. Why is it so hard to figure this out?
Well, I think it's in part because the technology changes so much. And, you know, we can't really hold a radar gun up against, oh, say, how fast a Walter Johnson threw or a Smokey Joe Wood or a Bob Feller. So we have that, you know, problem. But I don't believe the radar gun is the end-all to beat-all either. I was, in part, one of the places I was at in the course of doing high heat, the research for it, I went down to Durham, North Carolina, in part because the movie Bull Durham plays into the book, and also because David Price was then, who's now with the Tampa Bay Rays, was then with Durham, so it was easy to interview him there. And at one point, I was there for several days, and I was sitting in the crowd. I was sitting with a lot of the scouts. There was about a half a dozen of them there that day. And I like hanging with scouts because scouts like to tell stories. I mean, they've got very much the history of the game. They like to tease out these threads. They were all using the same make of radar gun. And somebody was on the mound. I don't believe it was David, but he threw pretty hard. I mean, it was a pretty, woo, you know, it was like one of those pitches that kind of woke everybody up and stopped the conversation. And I just kind of yelled out, what do we got for that? And, you know, I'm sitting in the midst of these scouts, all using the same type of technology. And one said 93, another said 95, another said 91.5. And I'm going, and that's when it kind of hit me that we put so much of a basis on technology and somehow some number that we can find is going to settle all this. Well, it doesn't. And I think in very many ways, when you're talking about this infatuation with the fastball, it's really, you're starting to talk about stories, and you're talking about individuals as opposed to raw numbers.
You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the fastball. Tim Wendel is our guest. He's the author of High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball, and The Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. If you have a comment or question for Tim, give us a call at 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. 8513 and send emails to allsides@wosu.org or post a note on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Tim, you're a fairly decorated author. You've written six books. You're the founding editor of USA Today's Baseball Weekly. Why did you decide to go on this kind of bizarre quest to find the fastest pitcher of all time?
Well, Steve, it was kind of interesting. I was down in Cuba, and I've been to Cuba several times, in part because with baseball, I did a novel, Castro's Curveball, that set in Havana, like in the late 1940s, etc. So we were at the ballpark there one day, and now, you know, Cuba's a little bit of a step back in time. It's kind of like the land time forgot in a lot of ways. But we're at the old stadium there in Havana, and there's a bunch of us, some Anglos, Cubans, etc. And we're just talking, because I think that's one of the great things about going to a baseball game. You know, you're watching the game, but then you're usually having this conversation with whoever you've gone to the game with.
Yeah, it's a very social sport.
Yeah, it's great. And all of a sudden we started talking about who's the fastest pitcher of all time. And everybody had an opinion. And I remember thinking to myself, leaving the ballpark that night, I was going, wow, if that debate can resonate here in Havana, where they had, you know, can't really watch Major League Baseball. They certainly know what's going on in baseball in general, but if you walked in with, Joey Votto and Cal Ripken, they probably wouldn't recognize them, even though they would probably know those guys' stats. Mm-hmm. And I found myself thinking, this could be kind of fun. And I realized kind of early on, with the help of Frank Howard, the former home run hitter who lives kind of in my area down here in D.C.
Originally from Columbus, Ohio.
That's right. The Capital Punisher. And he was the one who advised me, well, this could be pretty interesting, but you're going to have to realize it's going to be kind of a journey thing. You're going to have to go out and, you know, talk with a lot of these folks. And so hence, you know, it's spending several days with a Nolan Ryan. It's spending several days and more conversations, phone conversations, with, say, Bob Feller before his death. It's talking with, you know, many of the current guys like David Price or Tim Lincecum, or, you know, even talking with the scouts about Aroldis Chapman. And so, you know, it's very kind of winding, and it goes all over. But in many ways, I think it's very indicative of the game. In recent history, it's been easy to kind of see the home run thread through baseball. You know, go back to Babe Ruth and on to Roger Maris, et cetera, on up to McGuire and et cetera, today's situation or, controversy. But I think you can also go through baseball, just following the epic fireballers. It's almost uncanny how one career is ending, there's somebody to kind of step up. Walter Johnson kind of hands off the torch to a Bob Feller. Bob Feller then kind of hands it off to a golden era that includes people like Nolan Ryan and, you know, Koufax slightly before then, Drysdale, J.R. Richard. And I would say right now we're even entering another one with guys like Chapman. We'll see if Steven Strasburg comes back, you know, continuing development of guys like Justin Verlander and David Price.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller on the line, John, calling from Dublin. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Hi there. My question is, I wonder, you know, like the four-minute mile, whether you think that there is an upper limit for speed, that, or are humans going to continue to develop their potential? You know, so do we get faster and faster over the years, or is there an upper limit that's been prescribed?
Tim, you would have more insight in that. I don't think speed has increased all that much over the last few decades, really, has it?
No, it really hasn't. Perhaps our ability to measure speed has gotten better, or we think it's gotten better, you know, hence the radar gun and such. But, John, one of the places I visited in doing high heat was down in Birmingham, Alabama. Dr. James Andrews, who's kind of the surgeon to the sports stars. Mm-hmm. I mean, anytime you hear somebody getting hurt, they're going down to Alabama to visit Dr. Andrews. But he's got he's put together a very interesting biomechanics lab where they really, you know, try to calculate out torque and muscle strength and fast twitch versus slow twitch, etc. And so it's interesting there of the mind that speed is very similar to maybe time in the 100 meters and track. I mean, we're kind of hitting a ceiling, and certainly we can do things from a technology standpoint, maybe even an equipment standpoint. But after that, it's, you know, arguably a Walter Johnson is as fast as a Raldos Chapman. We just have different ways of measuring.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call, John. We do have an email from a Facebook message, rather, from Paul. Obviously, there are no radar guns or clocking in early baseball, but what estimates do you have for pitch velocity in that area? Example speeds, roughly, that Ruth and Mathewson throw. When did extremely hard throwing start, and why? Was I think you mentioned James Creighton was the first fireballer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, James Creighton pretty much goes back to right after the Civil War. And you talk to the folks in Cooperstown, they will insist that James Creighton, who pitched for the Brooklyn team at that point, not the Dodgers, but well before then, one of the kind of club teams, was as kind of instrumental in the way that baseball is now viewed and played as Babe Ruth was. And when they kind of rolled that out to me, I was like, what? But in a way, James Creighton was the guy who, in a sense, started because he threw so hard and nobody could really put a bat on the ball, hence came, four balls would be a walk, three strikes would be an out. The beginnings of a strike zone started then. We're talking well before the beginning of the last century. And from there, things kind of take off. I think if you look at, you want velocity numbers, and these are a little suspect at times. So one of my favorite stories is Walter Johnson on an off day in New York. The Remington Rifle Factory asked him to come up to Connecticut, where one of their big factories was, to potentially have his fastball, graded, gauged. And because they had a machine that could kind of tell projectiles, in a sense, bullets from guns and things like that. Walter Johnson gets up there, and somebody really hasn't quite done their research because the machine is set up and it can't really be changed, in essence, to throw at about a three-quarters delivery, you know, what you usually see even now today in the major leagues. Well, Walter Johnson, as fans will know, didn't throw at three-quarters. He almost threw at sidearm. In a sense, his arm was more dropped down. Mm-hmm. And everybody was very disappointed and kind of went, oh, this is too bad. We're sorry. We kind of messed up. And Johnson, to his credit, said, well, you know, you've put all this time into it. I am here. I don't throw this way, but let's give it a try. And so he threw and was clocked at 94, throwing, in a sense, a delivery that wasn't his usual delivery. And from there, you have all these kind of very strange testings. You know, I alluded to the Bob mm-hmm. Feller motorcycle test in Chicago. Feller, this is 1941 when Feller's in his prime. He's in Grant Park in Chicago, and they ask him to, he's in civilian clothes. In fact, he's wearing wingtips, and they ask him to throw a ball at a target. And what they don't tell him is right about the time they give him the signal to throw, a Harley-Davidson motorcycle with a Chicago policeman doing 87 miles an hour was going to go roaring past him on the right side, you know, within a couple of feet. And if you look at the old footage, you see Feller kind of flinch and then, oh, okay, hang on, they told me to throw. And so he threw. And they filmed it. And you see the ball pass the motorcycle. And supposedly, and I underscore supposedly, enough variables were satisfied that they could calculate that that day in Chicago in 1941, Bob Feller threw 104.5, and, you know, not even in spikes or anything like that. And so I think this is part of the fun
right.
with all this, is the stories and the lore, as opposed to being able to just aim a radar gun at somebody and saying, yep, that's definitively what it is. There is no definitive when it comes to this.
Well, we've got a ton more to talk about. Listeners, we're going to take a quick break and then come back, hopefully get to some more of your calls. Give us a call if you have a question for Tim Wendel, the author of the new book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. We'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio, a little more pleasant than it's been over the last few weeks. Sunny skies and a high of about 85 today. Tonight, clear, a low of 67. Then on Friday, sunny. Tomorrow's high, about 91 degrees. Friday night, mostly cloudy and a low near 71. And then on Saturday, well, things go south a little bit. Mostly cloudy on Saturday with the chance of showers and thunderstorms. And the high on Saturday is expected to be about 89 degrees.
I'm Jackie Leiden. Coming up on the next On Point, the Rhode Island city of Central Falls is broke. It's cops and firemen waiting to get paid. Is this the future? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann Fisher. And today we're talking about baseball and its most famous pitch, the fastball. We're joined by acclaimed author and baseball journalist Tim Wendel. He's the author of the new book, High Heat, The Secret of the Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. If you have a comment or question for Tim, want to talk about fastballs or just talk about baseball in general, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. And most of us have heard of the greatest pitchers of all time, Nolan Ryan, Randy Johnson, Sandy Koufax, on and on and on. But there are really some interesting characters sort of on the underbelly of the fastball that you've talked about. You dabbled on Steve Dalkowski. We do have a clip from a film that took inspiration from Dalkowski's story. Let's give it a listen and see if people can figure out who we're talking about.
No. He's looking for heat. Let me give him the deuce.
This son of a bitch is throwing a two-hit shutout. He's shaking me off. You believe that? Charlie, here comes the deuce. And when you speak of me, speak well.
Told him I was gonna throw a deuce, right?
Yep. Man, that ball got out of here in a hurry. You know, anything travels that far ought to have a damn stewardess on it, don't you think?
I did take out I did shorten that up a little bit to help with our time, and I, of course, took out some curse words. And that is, of course, from the movie Bull Durham. I didn't know this before looking at your book, but Steve Dalkowski was the inspiration for Tim Robbins' character, Nuke LaLouche. Tell us more about Steve Dalkowski.
Steve, he's like, I think this is one reason why it's so much fun at times to write books, because sometimes you hear about somebody. I didn't know much about Steve Dalkowski at all before I started on the research for High Heat. But you're right. Steve Dalkowski was the inspiration for Nuke LaLouche, and large part because Ron Shelton, who wrote and directed Bull Durham, he's done many other movies, White Man Can't Jump, et cetera. And I didn't realize that Shelton was an infielder in the Baltimore Orioles organization. He never made the major leagues, but he came. He was like 4 or 5 years behind Delkowski, who was also in the Orioles minor league system, and again, never quite made the major leagues. He came so close. And so Shelton heard all these stories, and many of them make it into Bull Durham. In fact, I sat down with Delkowski, who is back in New Britain, Connecticut, which is his hometown, and I asked him, okay, you know, hitting the mascot, throwing one over the backstop that I guess hits the announcer's booth, throwing one through a screen, all these things he did. And, and there's even, for real fans of the movie, next time you see it or whatever, there's a very nice nod or acknowledgement to Steve Delkowski and maybe what could have been in his career. As Nuke is being called up, I believe it's Robert Wall, the actor, and some kid, they're talking about how good Nuke was. And they say something effective, you know, how good was he? And somebody says, well, he struck out 262 and he walked 262, which is exactly what Steve Delkowski did in 1960 in Class C ball in Stockton. So it's, you know, Delkowski is not a guy that a lot of people have heard about, but we've certainly heard about his alter ego here in Nuke LaLoosh. And in many ways, he's kind of a cautionary tale that we tend to think that, you know, being able to throw 100 miles an hour or, you know, faster, how great that would be. Steve Delkowski, it didn't really work out for him. He got hurt. Ironically, he was hurt the day in spring training, hours after he'd been measured for big league uniform. He was going north with the Orioles. His minor league manager at that point had been Earl Weaver. Ironically, his one of his roommates was Pat Gillick, who just went into the Hall of Fame as a general manager for Toronto and Philadelphia. And he got hurt. He hurt his elbow. Ironically, it would have probably been a Tommy John surgery today. He probably could have been able to come back like a Steven Strasburg is now. Mm-hmm. But after that, things just spun out of control for Steve. He ended up becoming a migrant worker in the Imperial Valley in California. Ended up becoming an alcoholic. He became homeless for almost 2 years in L.A., but his family found him, and he was like this local hero, like something out of that Bruce Springsteen song Glory Days back in New Britain, Connecticut, where he's from, and they brought him back home, and he's now a celebrity again, and he's a guy that, you know, shows up at the high school games where, you know, he once struck out like 25 guys and stuff like that. So he very much was like somebody I just kind of knew in passing, and became one of the major characters, arguably, of High Heat.
I think both Earl Weaver and Ted Williams say that Delkowski was the fastest pitcher they ever saw.
Yeah. Williams, at one point, wanted to take a couple swings against him at spring training. I believe it was 1959, 58, soon after Steve signed. And Williams said he could not see the ball. You know, here you have maybe the last guy to hit better than 400.
Yeah, maybe the greatest hitter of all time.
And he stepped out of the cage and just said, I'm never going back in against that guy. He'd kill me. I'd never see it. And Weaver is the guy that really almost turned around Delkowski's career. You know, he did a number. He actually gave the whole team IQ tests in Elmira. That was a minor league town where they were all at, in part because trying to help out Steve. And you know, Weaver kind of brings up, you know, an interesting thing, because I interviewed Earl Weaver among many people for High Heat. And at one point, I was about ready to anoint Steve Delkowski as the fastest of all time. And yet Earl Weaver, and to a lesser extent Pat Gillick, who were very much, you know, Steve Delkowski proponents, advocates, still are his friends today, both of them raised an issue that it was difficult for me to then make him number one. They said, how can you name somebody number one who never made the major leagues? And certainly Steve Delkowski came very close, but he never pitched a single pitch at the major league level.
We do have another caller on the line, Mike, calling from Hilliard. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Question and a comment. Tim, now, do you think a pitcher that leads the league in strikeouts five seasons belongs in the Hall of Fame?
Probably. Who are we talking about, Mike?
Well, sudden Sam McDowell.
There you go.
You never hear his name come up. or anything like that, you know, and I think it's an injustice. But also about Sudden Sam McDowell, he's on the all-time given up hits per game.
Mm-hmm.
He's 9 on that list.
And I think it's funny because you're right, Mike. He gets overshadowed at times in part because some of the hitters, I know Reggie Jackson at one point was a little dismissive of him because he felt he threw very hard, but maybe wasn't the best thinking, you know, kind of pitcher out there. Many people kind of view, at least some of the folks I talk to, view McDowell kind of like a Ryan, or maybe even to a certain extent a Sandy Koufax early in their careers before they became kind of pitchers. The other thing is he was kind of overshadowed by guys like Louis Tiant and such some seasons there in Cleveland. But it's funny, you talk to, guys from that era.
Bob Uecker.
Yeah.
Bob Uecker said he was the fastest guy he ever saw.
Yeah, and Tommy John, who's in the book mostly because of his surgery, feels he was the fastest too. And it's interesting because you can kind of, I have to put, you know, Sudden Sam maybe in the same category with like a Virgil Fire Trucks and things like that. And again, this is where we start having some fun with the stories because there is no definitive thing. And certain guys really go to bat for other guys. It's funny, when I was talking with Nolan Ryan, and one of the things I did in the course of doing High Heat was everybody I interviewed, and I interviewed close to 100 people, everybody from Norm Sherry, who was Koufax's catcher, to like Feller, Ryan, etc. The last question I would ask them is, okay, who's your fastest guys of all time? And, you know, it can be starters, it can be relievers, I don't care. And I learned after a while, after I kind of put that question out there, to be quiet. And, you know, because usually people would protest saying, oh, you can't compare eras and, you know, this and that. But then invariably they would have their list. And I just kind of kept track of everybody's list. And it's funny who advocates or who is a proponent for who. One of the guys, Nolan Ryan, was as adamant about as some guys were about Sudden Sam was Billy Wagner. And he was just saying, Billy Wagner needs to be in this conversation. You know, and it's just kind of funny who they kind of really champion in a way.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. You're talking about answers you got from people when you asked them that question. The gentleman from Columbus in Ohio State we were talking about earlier, Frank Howard, the exact quote you put in the book is, the question you're asking doesn't have a pat answer. It's one of those deep ones, one for the ages. Like you flip over the rock and it leads you to something else and then something else again. And Bob Feller had an interesting answer as well. He said, the world will never know, may never agree, but it sure is fun to talk about, isn't it? So I think that really is, those are two quotes that sum up your book pretty well. If you want to talk to Tim Wendell about his quest to find the fastest pitcher of all time, he has a new book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, that's 614-292-8513. And Tim, we were talking about Bull Durham. Why do you suppose there are so many great baseball movies? You know, you can say Field of Dreams. If you consider Major League a great movie, I certainly do. It's a major movie of my childhood, being a Cleveland Indians fan. You can list the baseball movies, go on and on and on, but there aren't so many great football or basketball movies.
Well, I think it's in part because, Steve, you know, I'd certainly throw The Natural in there too, and, you know,
of course.
But one of the interesting things the baseball has going for it from a narrative standpoint or a story standpoint is it often breaks down to one-on-ones. And so it's very kind of easily understood in that way. I mean, you know, we're thinking Major League or Field of Dreams or The Natural. I mean, the pivotal scenes in there, the pivotal game action scenes are pretty much in a bat where, you know, is he going to strike out or is he going to hit it, you know, type of thing. And I think, again, even the casual fan understands that. And I think in a lot of ways it's where baseball maybe is similar to maybe the old Westerns, you know, where, you know, we've got the duel or the, you know, the showdown on Main Street. And I remember a couple of years ago I was out in L.A., and I went out to a Dodger game with some Hollywood people, which is always interesting. And one of them was a very prominent director who did not know baseball that well. And we were talking, and about the third or fourth inning, he just kind of stopped. He said, I get it. And I go, what do you mean? And he just was like looking out at the infield there at Chavez Ravine. And he goes that, you know, the infield, you know, it's kind of like the stage. And certainly you've got an outfield and things are going to happen, and certainly. But everything kind of starts right there. And it kind of starts with the guy who has the ball, the pitcher, and he puts things in motion. And, okay, is this character going to do this or whatever? And I think in a lot of ways that's one of the real attractions with baseball, is you can kind of very easily see, oh, it's pitcher versus hitter, or it's maybe even fielder versus the ball, et cetera, and you have these beautiful kind of freeze frame moments. Whereas, you know, I love basketball and I love football, and, you know, I even grew up, you know, near the Canadian border, you know, playing hockey and such. But to write it at times is a little difficult, because, say, somebody maybe goes around a right end for a touchdown for Ohio State. Well, yeah, that guy maybe ran 65 yards, but there was about 8 or 9 individuals there doing key blocks and all this other stuff. And even though all of them are important, it becomes a little bit more difficult to kind of sum that up in a very quick thing somebody can see. And I think that's, again, one of the things why baseball still, you know, kind of still resonates. We're told it's slow. We're told, yeah, and some of these games go on forever, et cetera. But still, you know, you think of the big moments, Kirk Gibson hitting the home run off Eckersley, you know, even the natural with Robert Redford, et cetera. You know, this is what triggers, and this is kind of the images we can still carry in our heads.
And baseball fans just devour this stuff. I have friends personally who going to a game is almost like church for them. It really is. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I as a student at Ohio State, I went to all the football games, and the atmosphere there is amazing. But going to a baseball game, it's just different. It's not as pumped up. It's not quite as exciting. But it's more spiritual. It really is.
Yeah, and I think in some ways it's kind of the pauses kind of leading up to some big event. And I think one of the things that's interesting about baseball is, yeah, we can focus on the pitcher, and I certainly do in high heat. I mean, these guys just enthrall me. I mean, how fast they can throw, and, you know, how it's almost like they're throwing thunderbolts from above type of thing. But you can kind of shift your attention, and especially if somebody's on base, you can see, okay, who's going to cover, you know, if he's going to steal, who's going to cover second? Is it going to be the second baseman, shortstop? I mean, what kind of pattern do they have going if it's a possible bunt? And I think maybe that's one of the things that baseball has fallen off maybe a little bit by, because it's one of those games that it's not, you know, at least at these levels we're talking about, not readily understood unless you have somebody there who's kind of explaining it to it. Baseball is a game that's handed down through generations, whereas
absolutely
basketball or even football, you know, somebody can show up and kind of get the gist of it, you know, relatively early. And I think in some ways this is maybe why baseball's having some tough times, besides the games that take 4 hours or so, is that nobody's there kind of on your shoulder going, oh, hang on, they got a guy on first. You think they're going to bunt, or you think he's going to steal? And, oh, how do you think they're going to defend this? And all of a sudden we're into this guessing game that makes baseball kind of the game within the game.
Sure. Listeners, give us a call, 292-8513. We do have some callers on the line. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Tim Wendel, the author of High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. We'll be right back here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Looking ahead to Hour 2 of All Sides this morning, Steve will have as his guests John Biewen, who is the audio program director of Duke University Center for Documentary Studies, and Katie Davis. She is a commentator for All Things Considered and also contributes to the program This American Life. The topic of the program will be True Stories on Radio. That's coming up in hour number 2 today of All Sides here at 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
In the weather forecast for Columbus, good news. A high of 85 degrees with lots of sunshine today. I believe the meteorological term is abundant sunshine. Tonight, clear skies, a low of 67 degrees. Then on Friday, We'll have sunny skies. Tomorrow's high should be somewhere around 91 degrees. By Friday night, mostly cloudy, low of 71, and those clouds coming in mean business. By Saturday, we'll be having cloudy skies with a chance of showers, maybe even a thunderstorm or two. And the high on Saturday should be somewhere around 89 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from Antioch University Midwest, helping working adults complete their bachelor's degree by offering 7 broad BA programs, including health and wellness and humanities. Details at midwest.antioch.edu.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Steve Brown, filling in for Ann Fisher today. And man, that song will take you back. We're talking baseball today, more specifically baseball's most famous pitch, the fastball. And we're joined by Tim Wendell. He's a baseball journalist and the author of the new book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. If you have a comment or question for Tim, give us a call. The number is 614-292-8513. Again, that's 614-292-8513. And I believe Wayne has been holding the line the longest. Wayne, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. Most of the discussion has been on starting pitchers. What about relief pitchers? And I have a particular relief pitcher that goes way back to 1961. His name is Ryan Duren.
Mm-hmm.
He pitched for the New York Yankees. This guy's eyesight was so bad, he had to wear thick lenses, and because it was sunny, he wore sunglasses. And when he would come out to pitch for relief, when he'd throw the ball, sometimes it'd be thrown into the dirt, sometimes above the catcher, off to the side. I saw one game where the bases were loaded in the ninth inning. The Yankees were ahead by one run. There were no outs facing the Detroit Tigers. And he struck out three Tigers in the middle of the lineup with nine pitches.
He was quite the character. Yeah, when he's in High Heat, kind of with a cameo. And it's funny, I talked to some of the old guys who hit against him, and they knew that a lot of this was probably, and I underscore probably, an act where, you know, his wildness and such, he wasn't quite sure where the ball was going. In fact, it was either the last pitch or the second to last pitch, he'd usually throw it to the backstop. And I remember talking with a couple hitters on that. They go, we know this was an act, but still, when you got into the batter's box against them, your knees were shaking. You're not quite sure what you were going to do.
The act worked, huh?
That's right. And so you're about ready to bail out. And I think this is, again, a little bit of the attraction to about the fastball is it can sting. I mean, and there's even, we have a section in the book about, even some of, the tragedies with fastball, like Ray Chapman and a Tony Conigliaro, et cetera. And so even, I think Reggie Jackson probably summed it up the best. He was talking about Nolan Ryan. And Reggie Jackson said something to the effect of, hey, I was a fastball hitter. I loved hitting fastballs. But when I get in against somebody like a Nolan Ryan, and I think you put a Ryan Duren in there or, a Sandy Koufax, it's like, I like fastballs like I love ice cream. But these guys are just shoving it down my throat, and plus that I'm half scared anyway because they may come in too far inside and buzz me. So it's kind of interesting how this one, we think, simple pitch, the first pitch, we learned the throw in Little League, et cetera, can have all these kind of ramifications.
Another reliever that made your list, Goose Gossage.
Yes, I mean, and I think in some ways, Goose is certainly, several people lobbied that he was, the fastest ever, whether a starter or reliever. But one thing I love about Goose is you look back and things have become so specialized now. I mean, like a Mariano Rivera or a Jonathan Papelbon, it's unusual if they're going to pitch probably longer than just try to close out the ninth. I mean, Gossage would come in and pitch several innings, whatever it took. And I think in some ways there's a change going on within baseball that potentially a lot of these fireballers coming up have been kind of in a sense, babied a little bit. And I think that's changing now quite to a certain extent. Nolan Ryan, just before I got down to visit him, you know, a couple summers ago when I was doing High Heat, had just sent off a message, a letter to all the minor league clubs and the Rangers organization saying pretty much, we are not counting pitches anymore. We should know enough about the game and enough about our talent that if they're going to go longer, they should be able to do it. Conversely, if they're struggling, we'll pull them out. So it's interesting. So much, and I think so much money is at stake. I mean, so much, you know, you look at the signing bonuses and such, that it's, again, easy to kind of quantify it in numbers, like a 100-pitch limit for a young arm. Yet that might not be quite right for every young pitcher that's coming up.
Yeah, looking at your book, Goose Gossage in 1977 had 11 wins and 26 saves. So that'll give you an indication of how pitchers used to pitch back then. Another caller, Linda, calling from Columbus. Go ahead, Linda, you're on the air.
Okay, well, my favorite baseball player of all time is Satchel Paige, and you hadn't mentioned him.
Mm-hmm. He's in the book.
Yeah, he's okay. Very much in it. And as
you see, I will read the book, because the thing I love about baseball is stories. And I don't think there's enough people nowadays who understand terms like stop insane and pray for rain or tinker stabbers to chance. What does that mean? You know, and there's so much history there that needs to be shared. So I read all the books. I will read yours. I love John Feinstein's books. It's for the story.
Yeah, it's very much the story. And it's funny, Linda, you bring up Satchel, and I hadn't been mentioning him enough because he's pretty high up in the book, and there's a big section on him. But it's interesting because he's one of these individuals that at least most of the country didn't see him at his best. In a sense, you know, he came, you know, he finally makes the major leagues after 40, et cetera. And it's interesting how he would pop up periodically. In one of the conversations I had with Bob Feller, and I know Bob really saw himself as kind of the fireballer who inherited the mantle of this greatness from Walter Johnson. And we were talking one day, and Bob, in a lot of ways, thought he was the fastest, and it's difficult to argue against that. But I was talking with him, and I kind of said, you know, Bob, besides yourself, who do you think was the fastest? And the first name he said immediately wasn't Walter Johnson. He said Satchel Paige. And I think in a lot of ways, Bob Feller perhaps knew Satchel Paige, you know, as well as anybody at his best, because they barnstormed together. You know, they had these planes, and they went around the country, and they played. You know, he often pitched against Satchel Paige in these barnstorming games. And so, you know, Bob Feller had a great deal of respect for Satchel. And I think it's funny, you know, we think everything's so easy with the fireballers, and you know, here you have an individual though like Satchel Paige, where he doesn't really make the biggest stage until, in a sense, his fastball is not what it used to be. And one of the themes that kind of runs through High Heat is this gift of a fastball. Is it ultimately going to be a blessing or a curse? And I think easily a third of the individuals in High Heat, and I'm thinking now more probably of Steve Delkowski or a guy named Amos Rushi, who goes back to the 1890s and such, kind of the Forrest Gump of baseball at that point, they are blessed with these great arms, but things don't really work out for them. It's almost kind of like a Midas touch. And in many ways, I think that's something in reading these stories we can see, you know, mm-hmm. because I think all of us are given some gift. Part of living a life is, can you bring that gift to fruition? And that's what all these guys struggled with, from Nolan Ryan on down.
And Linda, thanks so much for your call. And that is indeed another theme of the book, that it is a gift. It's not something you can really develop.
No, I think that's what's so unusual about it, Stephen. Something I loved in doing the research for High Heat is it's almost you can put a police lineup of all these these guys we've been talking about, Ryan Duran, Satchel Paige, Nolan Ryan, Sandy Koufax, Billy Wagner, etc. There is no correlation in height or weight. And in a sense, you know, it's not like basketball where it makes sense. Okay, it makes sense to be tall, or football, or makes sense to be, you know, muscular or whatever. It's almost like, you know, some higher power, whatever, God just kind of came down periodically and went, bing, mm-hmm. you've got the, you know, you have the gift of high speed or high heat, and now what can you do with it? And I think so often we think it's easy for these guys because, again, speed is something that's easily recognized. I mean, we even see it in Little League and in Babe Ruth and the youth level leagues. Oh, that guy's throwing really hard. That must be really easy for him. But if you look at all these pitchers, they really struggled at some point. Nolan Ryan told me how close he came to quitting. And I asked him why. And he said, because I knew I wasn't doing right by what I'd been given. You look at somebody like a Sandy Koufax, who really, if you look at his stats, it's almost two careers kind of wedged into one. The first 5 or 6 years are pretty mediocre.
Yeah, same with Randy Johnson.
Yeah, and that's why these guys kind of look out for each other a little bit. Randy Johnson only becomes great, a Hall of Fame pitcher, because one day Nolan Ryan and Tom House, then the pitching coach for the Texas Rangers, go by him and they see him throwing in the bullpen. They never were on the same team. And Ryan tells the coach, you get word to him, I'll have lunch with him and I'll try to help him, you know, because in a sense, he recognized how much Johnson was struggling. And Ryan realized quickly remembered how much he had struggled, you know, coming up with the Mets. I mean, one of the most amazing quotes in High Heat that I just kind of stumbled across is Gil Hodges, after Nolan Ryan is traded to the California Angels and for Jim Fregosi, and very lopsided trade. Gil Hodges, then manager of the Mets, and this isn't to criticize Gil Hodges, who was a great manager, great player, but he said something effective: all the good young pitchers I have right now, and that was on the Mets, you're talking Tom Seaver, Gary Gentry, Jerry Kuzman, Tug McGraw, I guess Nolan Ryan is the one I can most afford to lose. And you just go, whoa. And that's a failure of an organization. That's a failure of them not being able to quite reach him and fix both mechanically and also mentally the hurdles he had to overcome.
Yeah, pitcher that goes on to set several strikeout records and throw 7 no-hitters.
Yeah, and becomes within, I think it's 8 votes of being a unanimous selection to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, we do have another caller on the line. John calling. John, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, John. Are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Haven't heard any mention about Bob Trilling.
Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a bit of it. I mean, it's kind of interesting when you talk with everybody, kind of the – I almost felt like it was like that line from Casablanca, Round Up the Usual Suspects, because I would – talk with folks and, again, ask them to put together their list of the fastest, and I even let some people go 12 or 15 deep. And very quickly, the top half dozen names, and we've been talking about them, Feller, Koufax, Ryan, Delkowski, Ryan Duren, et cetera, come to mind. And then I kind of felt there was this kind of, I don't want to say second tier, but there would be another group where they would get a great deal of attention, and this would be guys like Virgil Firetrucks and Son Sam McDowell, even Louis Tiant, in his prime, etc. And that's where he tended to fall. And again, there was nothing really scientific about this, even though I kept a big Excel spreadsheet, and it's probably as scientific as the BCS, bowl things in football. But it was interesting how quickly the same 6-8 names kind of rose up, and you could kind of throw a blanket over those guys.
Tim, who's the hardest thrower now? Is it Aroldis Chapman, Joel Zamaya? Is it Tim Lipscomb? Who do you think it is?
Well, I would say Chapman, even though I think the jury's a little bit out, because even though he's been clocked, it's 105, 106, some of the old-timers and some of the old scouts would again claim, hey, a Walter Johnson arguably threw his fast, a Sandy Koufax in his prime, a Ryan. And I think there's also a little bit of a wait and see on this new crop of young Turks, so to speak. Are they going to have? It's not like they've got to pitch forever or have Hall of Fame careers. But Chapman's still so new, on the scene, that I think some individuals within baseball are still trying to wrap their mind, around him. Okay, where does he rank? Is he in with a Feller? Is he in with a Ryan? And I think in a lot of ways the Steven Strasburg kind of falls into that too. And, how is Strasburg going to come back? I mean, he certainly woke up the echoes here you know, in D.C., you know, near where I live, but it was like a quick kind of shooting star. Is it going to kind of stay out there for a little bit that we can kind of put him in a conversation with some of these guys, Koufax, Feller, Ryan, et cetera, that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think in his major league debut, he struck out 14 batters.
Yeah.
When you watch these smaller guys like Billy Wagner and Tim Lincecum throw so hard, it almost looks painful. It makes you wonder how they can throw as hard as a guy like Walter Johnson.
Well, here we get kind of in the metaphysical just a little bit, Steve. And, you know, Lincecum, there's been a lot written about, you know, in a sense, his delivery. And it's interesting, you talk to Tim Lincecum, and Tim is not a baseball historian.
He looks more like a skateboarder. He looks somebody you'd see at the X Games.
And I was hanging out with him one day, and they wouldn't let him in the visiting clubhouse in Washington because he didn't have his credential. They thought he was just some punk kid. But, you know, he can't really tell you maybe who won the 75 World Series. But you get talking about some of these guys, Ryan, Tiant, Koufax, he knows them. In part because he'll say, oh, a little bit when I do this with my delivery, that's a little bit of Koufax or that's a little bit of Ryan. And it's, you know, it's interesting how some of these guys kind of play out that way. Even though they may not be absolute baseball historians, they know whose footsteps they're in a sense, traveling in. And there's this kind of acknowledgement to, okay, I may not know how many games Walter Johnson won in 1920, but I know he's an icon out there, and in a sense, I'm trying to do something similar to what he's done.
And our editor, Tom Borgerding, could definitely tell you who won the 1975 World Series. That was the Cincinnati Reds and over the Red Sox and Carlton Fisk with that home run. Tim Wendell is the author of the new book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. Tim, I'm going to get down to brass tacks here. Who, if you had to guess, who is the fastest of all time?
I ended up going with Ryan. And in part because, and with Delkowski, Feller, actually Satchel Paige, Walter Johnson, and Koufax kind of right behind them. But I went with him, and again, we're getting back to this whole thing of a gift, you know. And I was really kind of enthralled by how close Ryan came to quitting. And then how quickly, not quickly, but how hard he worked then to turn his career around with the Angels and went on to the things we've been talking about, the seven no-hitters and such. And again, that's where I kind of come down. But it's certainly...
it's up for debate.
Certainly up for debate. But again, I think it's a different way to look at it. Who did the most with this gift of high heat?
Well, Tim, thanks so much. And it's a wonderful book, and it's a great read. And thanks for appearing on All Sides.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.